This week's Please Explain takes a look at something familiar to every New Yorker while remaining mysterious in some ways. Our subways. The city subways are among the oldest and most extensive public transportation systems in the world. And joining us now to tell us how they came to be built and how they transformed and shaped the city is transit historian Andrew Sparberg, a retired Long Island Railroad manager who directs the Railroad Technology Program at Technical Career Institutes, and John Turanek, who writes on New York architectural history and designs city maps and transit maps. Welcome to our show, and we also invite listener calls, but we want to keep it limited to the history of the subways. We'll be doing another segment somewhere down the line on the current situation. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment or question on our show page at WNYC.org. The first subway opened in New York in 1904, Andrew. Did many cities beat us to the punch?
Well, actually, six cities beat New York to the punch. London was the first that opened in 1863, then Glasgow in 1896, Budapest, which was the first in Europe, also in 1896, and Boston in 1897. That was the first in North America. Paris and Berlin also opened a few years before New York did.
But hadn't Commodore Vanderbilt built the first ever on Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn?
No, that tunnel you're thinking of on Atlantic Avenue was actually part of the Long Island Railroad line that ran from Brooklyn out to Jamaica and then east into Long Island. That dates from the 1860s. That was never part of the subway system.
Was the New York City subway modeled on any of the other cities that you mentioned?
Well, I mean, it was modeled on all of them to some extent because it borrowed features. The kiosks that we may remember, if you're as old as I am, that used to adorn the street corners actually were borrowed from Budapest.
I thought Paris.
Well, more Budapest than Paris, believe it or not, although somewhat Paris. The shallow tunnels were definitely borrowed from Boston, the idea being that build as close to the street surface as you can because it's easier to get up and down, unlike London, which early on went for very deep tubes, but that was because of the construction that was used in London as opposed to New York.
And John, one of the things that I associate with the old stations is how beautiful some of them are.
Oh, the stations were glorious.
Those mosaics are fabulous.
When the subway was initially planned, the stations basically were going to be engineered spaces. But the city government intervened and said, look, they have to be aesthetically pleasing. And August Belmont II hired the firm of Hines and Lafarge, who tangentially made the paper today because they had designed the Monkey House at the Bronx Zoo, which is closing. They had also won the competition for the Cathedral Church of St. John the Divine. These were pretty good architects.
What, was it always a combination of above ground and below ground trains?
Yes, from 1904, when the IRT, the first successful subway, opened, there was an elevated station at 125th Street, which was really Manhattanville, because it's more efficient for any railroad to operate on a level plane. So when there's a valley, and you have one at 125th Street, they built a viaduct.
But they also tended to build the elevated trains in less populated areas, didn't
yes,
they?
Yes, yeah, but it was cheaper.
Andrew, was Manhattan at that time, the system, especially the elevated system, similar to what we still see in use in Chicago? Because I remember some of those trains getting very close to buildings.
Oh, yes. The original elevated to Manhattan, if you're talking about 3rd Avenue, and there were also three others, 2nd, 6th, and 9th, all were built in the 19th century. We're very similar to what you see in Chicago, and the lines in Manhattan eventually had an extension in the Bronx along the upper part of 3rd Avenue as well. And that line is gone now, too. But the elevated extensions that are connected to the current subway system, those date from the primarily, at least in the Bronx, from the early 20th century. And those mirrored the original 19th century L's, but they were built stronger so that they could carry steel subway cars. The original Manhattan L's did not have the weight to carry steel subway cars.
So they had wooden cars. There was
wooden
still
cars,
some,
correct.
There was still some wooden cars on the Myrtle Avenue L,
right.
That was taken down,
correct.
I guess, in the 60s or 70s.
The Myrtle Avenue L was taken down in 1969, and that was part of an elevated system in Brooklyn that was built in the late 19th century, independent of the one in Manhattan. They weren't merged into one system until much later on. So Brooklyn was developing its own elevated system independent of Manhattan, and eventually the most important lines on that were rebuilt and became part of the subway system as well.
Were the elevated trains on the Far East and Far West sides of Manhattan taken down when those areas became more populated, or because they no longer were efficient because they relied on wooden trains?
Okay, well, in the case of the two on the west side, on 6th and 9th Avenue, they were taken down not only because they were becoming functionally obsolete with the wooden cars. The independent subway, which had been built in the 1930s, paralleled those lines almost exactly and made them really redundant. In the case of the east side lines on 2nd and 3rd Avenues, they were taken down because the Lexington Avenue line had been built about 1918, provided a parallel service, and also because they were considered an aesthetically not very pleasing. So the idea was take them down and build a 2nd Avenue subway to replace it, which finally now is underway. Now, that's been a big deficit in Manhattan, that there's been a lack of adequate service on the east side ever since the 3rd Avenue line came down in 1955.
So let's go back to the first line, John. Where did it go? It was the IRT?
It was the
Interborough Rapid Transit.
Right.
We have three different systems, IRT, Brooklyn-Manhattan Transit, BMT, and IND Independent.
And the BMT, if you're going to think about what those letters stand for, is Brooklyn-Manhattan Transit. Of course, the BMT goes to Queens, so it should properly be called the BMQT, but it's not. The original IRT ran a zigzag course from City Hall in Lower Manhattan up Elm Street for a bit, then Lafayette Street onto 4th Avenue, what we now call Park Avenue South. When it hit Grand Central, it turned west. And then when it went to the newly named Times Square, it zagged.
Wait,
north.
So it went down what is now the shuttle tracks?
What is today the shuttle, the 42nd Street shuttle, was part of the original configuration of the zigzag pattern.
Uh-huh. And the idea, I guess, was to try to cover as much as of Manhattan with one line as you could.
That's
at least
right.
the important part of Manhattan at that point.
And the coming of the subway to Times Square essentially created Times Square as a theater district.
Now, how was this financed?
Well, it was a very complicated financial deal. The property was rented from the city of New York. The subway itself, however, was privately built and financed, and that's where the banker August Belmont Jr. came in, because the contractor, John McDonald, needed money, and Belmont created a company. He was the president of the Interborough Rapid Transit Construction Company.
And Andrew, is Belmont Avenue in the Bronx named in his honor?
No, it's not. I don't believe it is.
Because Roebling got his own street in Williamsburg.
But well, Belmont Park racetrack is named after him.
Uh-huh. Right. How much did this first line cost? Was it an expensive project at the time?
My understanding, it was between $40 and $50 million.
That sounds like a lot of money in
those days.
In the early 20th century dollars.
Certainly was.
Why was it so expensive? Didn't they just simply dig a ditch and stick something over it?
Well, even in those days, you had to relocate all the utility lines. You had to provide for the trolley lines to operate, even though the streets were being torn up. And that was a Manhattan, let me just give you an aside, that was a really big deal, because the streetcars or trolleys, as people will often call them, operated with an underground power conduit. They could not use overhead wire, so that complicated things.
My guests are Andrew Sparberg, who's a subway historian, and John Turanek, who writes on New York architectural history and designs maps. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Were most of the early stations or lines made in the cut and cover technique?
Yes, as much as practicable, yes. The idea was that the chief engineer of the subway, a man named William Barclay Parsons, had visited London before construction started in New York. And he didn't like the deep stations. He said, New Yorkers are always in a hurry. They're not going to want to go, you know, go all the way down and go all the way up. Make the stations as close to the surface as you possibly can. So with some exceptions, the answer is yes.
And the deeper stations are usually the ones that are near the rivers. By that time, they...
Right, but not necessarily. The line, some of the original subway in Washington Heights... that was actually part of the original construction that opened in 1906, were built in a very deep tunnel because the terrain goes up. But for the same reason that the 125th Street station is elevated, these stations are in some cases 150 or even 200 feet below the street surface because the tunnel had to stay level.
John, was the IRT immediately profitable?
No.
The first fare was a nickel, which I would think would have been a lot of money in those
days. It was a lot of money. The average workman might have been lucky to make $1 or $2 a day. So if you think that 20% of your daily income is going to ride the subway, that's a good chunk of change. And the problem with the nickel fare is that it became a political hot football or hot potato, and the operators were stuck with it, and during World War I, for instance, when there was terrific inflation, there were strikes because the workers weren't getting increases. The management was not willing to pay them more. They couldn't make more money from the fare box.
Well, in London, you pay by the zone. Is the flat rate for a New York subway ride something that was unique to us?
Well, there are many systems, such as Washington here in the United States, that charge by zones. The flat fare was agreed upon as the best for New York, because one of the goals of rapid transit was to have the overcrowded Lower East Side, for instance, emptied of its people, so that they could get to the northern part of Manhattan or the Bronx.
So, Andrew, we have the IRT, this limited line.
Right.
When did it start growing, and when did the BMT come into the story?
Okay, well, the watershed year for that was 99 years ago, 1913. The city of New York signed something called the dual contracts with the two subway operating companies, the IRT and then the BRT, Brooklyn Rapid Transit, which is the predecessor of the BMT. And under this agreement, the city agreed to spend many, many millions of dollars to build new lines, not just in Manhattan, but in the other three outer boroughs as well. And some of those would be elevated to provide lines to allow for this dispersal of population outside of the overcrowded parts of Manhattan. So that was really the watershed. And that construction went on continuously from 1913 till 1931. And during that period, the BRT was reorganized and became the BMT. That happened in 1923, and that was partly because of a very unfortunate accident that occurred in 1918 at Prospect Park in Brooklyn, where a train derailed because of an inexperienced motorman at the helm because of a labor dispute at the time and killed nearly 100 people. That's the infamous Malbone Street wreck. And so that's why the BMT became the BMT.
How fast did these trains travel? Were they moving about as fast as they do now, John?
They traveled at about 25 or 30 miles an hour.
It's pretty much the same.
Yeah. And
except now they generally stop between tunnels a lot more, I suspect.
Well, if you ask the average person how quickly an express operates on the, I don't know, the two or the three in Manhattan, you're liable to hear 50, 60, 70 miles an hour, and they're not traveling half that speed.
Mm-hmm. Even when they go between 59th Street and 125th Street?
That's the greatest express run in Manhattan, but no, they don't go 60, 70 miles an hour.
Andrew, was the subway clean and well lit? I remember in my early days on the subway, all those signs against spitting.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you say about the original days, I mean, it was probably reasonably clean for a few years, and then as the hordes began descending on it, it probably wasn't, because one of the things about New York subway, it's always been a method to move a lot of people quickly and efficiently, but without any amenities. In fact, there's a when you talk about clean, there's a famous story about a man named Frank Headley, who was the president of the IRT for many years. He saw a crew in the yard cleaning the windows of a train, and he told them to stop. So they weren't going to waste money with clean windows. It was to move people, not necessarily in comfort. And it was probably as well lit as you could make it for its day. But I remember comparing today, when everything is has fluorescent or more modern lighting versus the old incandescents, it probably wasn't as well lit as it is today.
Well, one of the aspects of the design of the IRT is that the walls had white tiles and the corners are coved for, you know, as you see in hospital rooms, for instance. And the lighting was adequate. Many, many stations had what are called vault lights in the ceilings or dead lights. They're simply pieces of glass set in cast iron. And natural light enters the platform as a result. During the day, every day, unless the snow on the ground.
Now, were the trains powered the same as they are today, the third rail?
Yes.
So we're pretty much following the same design that we have been for over 100 years.
Yes. But when you asked about one of the distinctions of the New York subway vis-a-vis other lines, you have to remember that we have an express and local service. There are many areas of the subway where there are four tracks, two of which are dedicated for express service and the other two for local service. And that distinguishes the New York City subway, certainly in 1904, from all other lines.
Now, Andrew, I always understood the IRT and the BMT to have been municipal projects, and then the IND, a product of private enterprise. But that's not the case?
Each one of these
was built by a private company?
Well, no, it's sort of the other way around. The IRT and BMT, because of the dual contracts, were the structures themselves were built with city money, but they were leased to these two private companies for 49 years, beginning in 1913, for operational purposes. They were private companies. The IND, which was the construction of which first started in 1925, was municipally owned and operated from the get-go. It was always in the public sector. So from 1932, when the IND opened, until 1940, when the three systems finally were unified, you had three separate and competing systems.
Now, there must have been other kinds of competition because we have these uptown and downtown platforms at the stations at Bleecker Street and the 8th Avenue line at 42nd Street, totally unaligned. And I was told that was because of disputes between unions or between the companies that were building the platforms.
It was between the private companies and they simply built things independently of each other. There was no thought to having one system in the early years. And when you think of the name IND, independent, it was they called it the independent because it was independent of private money. It's a concept that completely eludes us today.
Now, they must have all had tracks that were pretty much set apart the same width because when we wound up combining them, trains could go from one line to the other.
Well, the gauge of the tracks is the same. Basically, it's the same as the width between the wheels of a Roman chariot. The difference between the IND and BMT and the IRT is that the IRT has narrower passenger cars, hence narrower tunnels. So if you operate an IND or BMT car on IRT tracks, it'll fit on the tracks fine, but it will crash into the walls.
Now, Andrew, is the subway system we have now pretty much the same thing we had around 1940?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the vast majority of the lines were built before 1940, but what happened with the unification in 1940 was now the city was in control of all three. And if I can just diverge back to the IND for a moment, the IND was built deliberately to be compatible with the BMT. So what happened after 1940 with the city in control, there were connections built between IND and BMT lines to allow those trains to operate on both lines, and that's why today those are combined into one division known as the B division. Those are the lettered lines. And the most important of those connections opened in November 1967, called Christie Street, that allowed trains from the IND 6th Avenue line to cross the Manhattan Bridge and run on all the BMT routes in the southern part of Brooklyn.
The subways don't go into certain parts of Brooklyn and Queens. And what happened to Staten Island? Were there ever plans to connect Staten Island to Manhattan and Brooklyn by train? Couldn't a subway link have been planned into the Verrazano Bridge?
Well, to answer that question, there's two ways to answer it. Number one, there was a plan in the 1920s that actually was started to build a tunnel from roughly 69th Street in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, across to Staten Island that would connect with the small rail line that's still on Staten Island today. And in anticipation of that, the line on Staten Island converted from steam to third rail electric that would be compatible with the BMT lines in Brooklyn. But this was started, and then it was stopped under mysterious circumstances and never resumed. It's kind of the stuff of legend, but it was started. Now then, fast forward 40 years to 1964 when the Verrazano Bridge opened. There was a plan to run tracks, at least there were ideas to run tracks on it, but because the Verrazano Bridge was built and operated by the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority, translation, Robert Moses. Moses was anti-rail, and he put the kibosh on having any rail on the Verrazano Bridge. So that's why it never has had rail.
A listener says most of the most of the IND lines have four-track systems for local and express trains, as you mentioned. Why does the 135th Street station on the west side, the ABCD lines, have six tracks?
That's because there's a major junction just north of there where you can go either to Washington Heights on one branch or onto the Grand Concourse in the Bronx on the other. And to allow proper sorting of trains, that was built as a six-track station.
Now, John, a listener asked, why do there seem to be curves on the tracks even when the train is going straight? Is this due to having to adjust to the geology of the various boroughs?
Well, when the track is curved, it no doubt is reflecting what's going on above ground. It was far cheaper to build subways under the streets. If you had to go under a building, you had to get an easement in order to do it. And that was frightfully expensive.
So if a street is curving a little bit, then the train's going to curve as well. David from the Upper East Side, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I've been involved as a community board member with the construction of the Second Avenue subway. And I've been wondering, there's a section of that subway is going to come down 2nd to 63rd and connect to the F line and go down 6th Avenue. There's a section of track on that F train track that runs east-west that continues over to 7th Avenue. And it's not used. Why can't the Second Avenue subway take advantage of both lines?
Now, Andrew, aren't there a whole bunch of tracks and hidden stations in the system?
Well, there are. I mean, there's all kinds of hidden stuff that you can, if you know where to look, you can find it. But very little of it is not used for revenue service. But to answer the gentleman's question, the Second Avenue subway is going to make use of that currently unused connection between the 63rd Street line and the BMT, the old BMT line. It's at 57th Street and 7th Avenue. The F will continue to use its current route going down 6th Avenue, so they will be able to interchange at the current station at Lexington and 63rd. Those platforms will become two-track platforms, not one-track platforms as they are now. That the wall you see there now is a false wall. It's going to be broken when the 2nd Avenue subway is operational.
John, the subway map was just chosen by our listeners as one of the objects that tell the story of New York. When were the first subway maps designed?
Well, when the IRT opened in 1904, there was no map that the IRT published. The first map that I know was put out by Wanamakers, and it was an ad for Wanamakers because they were right there at the Astor Place station, and they said it's convenient to take the subway to go shopping at Wanamakers. And it wasn't until 1910, that's 6 years after the subway opened, that the IRT actually promulgated its first map.
Now, other cities have very simplified subway maps, but New York's subway map shows the geography of the city. Is that a good thing?
Well, there was a former map that was diagrammatic and schematic.
Tourists wind up using subway maps to get around the city
precisely.
When they're walking.
You want to get from A to B you want to get not just from B to C to D, et cetera. You want to get from where you are to your ultimate destination. And that's why in 1979 the MTA came out with a quasi-geographic subway map, which has become, as I said the other day, quasier over the years, more and more distorted in its geographic reality. But in order to present the subway in relation to the city it serves required expanding certain areas of Manhattan especially and contracting other areas in the outlying districts where the operation of the system is simpler.
Andrew, you worked at the Long Island Railroad.
Correct.
Have there been attempts to integrate the two systems?
There have been attempts, but they've never been successful because there are many differences, but not just in the operations themselves, but the signal systems are quite different. The Long Island Railroad cars are 10 feet longer than the longest subway cars. Subway cars typically are 51, 60, or in some cases 75 feet long. Long Island Railroad and also Metro North and New Jersey Transit commuter coaches are 85 feet long. That's a railroad standard, so they are too big to fit on the subway tracks because of the curvature.
Just one more question. Listeners have been asking about the rat population in the subway. They feel it's increasing. Have we always had a rat problem in the system?
I think probably from the day they started digging the tunnels, yes.
Well, I'm assuming, Andrew, that you would agree.
Yes, and it's not just New York. I've been in other cities where I've witnessed the same thing with rodents on the tracks because they're on the grand tunnels, and it's a fact of life.
Andrew Sparberg is a subway historian who is also a retired Long Island Railroad manager and director of the Railroad Technology Program at Technical Career Institutes. John Taranak, who writes on New York City architectural history, also designs maps, both city maps and transit maps, and I think you designed the best subway map we ever had.
Well, thank you.
And thank you both so much for being on our show.
You're very welcome.
It was a pleasure.